You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Sherlock Holmes had problems with cocaine, and Charlie Sheen and Lindsay Lohan seem to have problems with practically everything. But why do people continue to drink, drug, gamble, and fornicate, even when it can cost them their families, their homes, and their jobs? The obvious answer is that it feels good, but now David J. Linden has taken a look beyond that simple explanation to the biology behind compulsions. His new book, The Compass of Pleasure, explores how our brains work to make what's so very bad for us downright irresistible. It's published by Viking, and it is a pleasure, a moderate and healthy one, I think, to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Are there different kinds of pleasure?
There are, and I think the thing to emphasize is that it's not just our vices that give us pleasure, that there are virtuous things as well.
But we often associate the word with pleasure with the adjective guilty.
We do, but there are things like learning and even charitable giving and exercise, all things that I think most people would consider virtuous. We're a very social species, and so receiving praise from people around us, all of these are things that—
Pleasures of art.
Art, aesthetic pleasure, absolutely. I think the thing that biology brings to this is that all these different pleasures, whether they are the virtues or the vices, all converge on activation of the same part of the brain. And this part of the brain we call the medial forebrain pleasure circuit.
So if I engage in one of the guilty pleasures, I'm stimulating the same part of my brain as when I'm enjoying looking at a Caravaggio?
To some degree, yes. And certainly they are overlapping. In other words, it's not going to be identical. And obviously they couldn't be identical because the experiences aren't identical. But for example, if we have you in a brain scanner while you're having an orgasm, we'll see this medial forebrain pleasure circuit light up. This is a part of the brain that's very dependent upon the neurotransmitter dopamine. If you are eating a good meal when you're hungry, if you are giving to charity or exercising or having an aesthetic experience, there are many different parts of the brain that light up, but there is that pleasure circuit as the final common pathway.
Have all societies tried to regulate pleasure?
I think if you look at societies and at religions, most of the rules we have, most of the laws on our books, most of the religious ideas are basically dopamine laws. They are designed to regulate how we have sex, how we eat, how we gamble. Think of how we artificially stimulate our pleasure centers with drugs. I mean, this is what our prisons are full of.
Have all cultures used drugs?
All cultures use drugs when there are drugs available. In many cases, though, drug use is restricted to a particular shamanic class. So there may be consumption of alcohol, but it's only in a ritual context, or consumption of hallucinogens, but only in a ritual context.
What's the range of drug use that we're discussing? Are we including alcohol and even caffeine?
So if you look at psychoactive drugs, many of them activate this pleasure center. So caffeine, nicotine, alcohol, heroin, cocaine, amphetamine all do, but not all drugs do. So, for example, the hallucinogens like LSD and mescaline do not. Prozac does not. Tranquilizers do not.
But many of those things are very accepted in certain cultures, the mind-bending drugs, and then others find them decadent and abominable.
Well, that's right. I mean, the mind-bending drugs, the hallucinogens, aren't actually part of the pleasure circuit activation. But certainly, even if you restrict yourself to pleasure circuit activation, obviously we have huge cultural differences in terms of the acceptability of even alcohol. So cultures make rules about this. We had prohibition. Many, many countries and cultures around the world have prohibition still, and many of the things that we make illegal are commonly used, or even sacraments in other situations.
Now, the addictive drugs are opiates, aren't they? But they're also depressants and soporifics.
Well, so opiates are just one class of addictive drugs. So, for example, cocaine and amphetamines and nicotine and alcohol, none of those things are opiates, and they are all addictive. So here's the rule to know whether a drug has the potential to be addiction. If it activates the dopamine system in this medial forebrain pleasure circuit, then there is a chance it can be addictive. And if it doesn't, like LSD doesn't, like Prozac doesn't, then it won't be. But what's really interesting is that the potential for addiction can be deeply counterintuitive. So we might say, well, heroin gives you a huge pleasure buzz, so that should be super addictive. And cigarettes give you a very weak pleasure buzz, so they should not be addictive. And yet, about 30% of all the people who ever try heroin become heroin addicts, and 80% of all the people who ever try cigarettes become cigarette addicts.
Now, they're addictive. The opiates are addictive.
They are.
Because we have these receptors in our brain because we create our own opiates, don't we, the endorphins?
Right. We create our own endorphins. We also create our own marijuana-like molecules called the endocannabinoids. So there are natural cannabis-like and natural morphine-like molecules in our brain. And I said that the final common pathway in this pleasure circuit used dopamine. So some of these drugs that artificially activate the pleasure circuit, like cocaine and amphetamine, directly affect dopamine. And other ones, like heroin and cannabis and alcohol and nicotine, indirectly affect it.
The same thing happened with other animals? Is the same sort of thing going on when a cat eats catnip?
Oh, absolutely. So catnip will activate dopamine signaling in the pleasure circuit of a cat, and that is one of the reasons why they return to it so predominantly. I think when thinking about this artificial activation, the thing we have to realize, we have to step back and think, why even have a pleasure center at all? Why should there be a place in your brain that, when it's active, gives you pleasure? And the answer is an evolutionary one, and it's fairly straightforward. You want to have things like eating food and drinking water and having sex be pleasurable so that you survive, have children, and propagate your genes into the next generation. But clever us, we figured out how to activate those things artificially, and that's what all these drugs we're discussing do.
And endorphins protect us when we're in terrible pain. They allow us to mask the pain until we can get help.
That's right. So endorphins affect both mood and pain perception. And what's interesting is that the psychoactive effect of a drug is very context dependent. So if you're in tremendous pain and you're getting some morphine to relieve the pain, you're unlikely to feel real euphoric in the same way that if you took that same morphine recreationally.
My guest is David J. Linden. His book, Compass of Pleasure, How Our Brains Make Fatty Foods, Orgasm, Exercise, Marijuana, Generosity, Vodka, Learning, and Gambling Feel So Good. Different cultures have had different drugs of choice. What was ancient Rome's favorite drug?
Oh, ancient Rome, the highlight there was opium. And it got to the point
where did it come from? From Asia?
Yes. Well, so from a lot of the places it comes from now. So opium poppies grow in the Middle East, Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, Persia. And there were trade routes to Rome from those places in those days, and that was a main source of the raw opium. And in those days, the opium was often consumed as a suppository or was eaten, or a nubbin was dissolved in a glass of wine, and it was completely legal. And it got to the point under Septimus Severus where about 30% of all the receipts for the emperor, 30% of the Roman federal budget, if you will, was tax on opium sales.
So is this one of the reasons for the fall of Rome?
You know, I'm not a historian, and I would be hard-pressed to comment on that. Sorry.
It's interesting that ether became popular in Ireland in the 1830s. Well, that's another opiate.
Ether is not an opiate, I'm sorry.
It isn't?
No. No.
Where does ether come
opiates
from?
Opiates are only things that are derived from poppies or for synthesized. So things like heroin and morphine are opiates.
So where does ether come from?
So ether is a very simple industrial chemical. You don't need to get it from a plant. You can synthesize it as a byproduct of distillation. And what happened in Ireland in the 19th century was that there was a tremendous alcohol tolerance movement called the Pledge by Father Matthew. And in about 1840, he got about 60% of the adult population of Ireland to agree to give up alcohol entirely. But of course, a lot of folks still wanted to get intoxicated, but they had signed this pledge, so they were in a bind. And a doctor named Draper realized that if you took a little ether, like a thimbleful, and ether is is a liquid at room temperature, but a gas at body temperature. It's very volatile. And if you down that, it's like getting drunk, but everything is speeded up. So within 3 minutes, you're dead drunk on the floor. It's as if you're deeply intoxicated. And within 20 minutes, it's like you're completely sobered up. So the cops would pick up an ether drunk, haul them back to the station. By the time they got them back, they'd be completely sober.
No hangover.
No hangover, but some terrible, terrible bad side effects. The ether vapors would come out in belches and farts. And so if you would sit at the pub next to the fireplace and break wind, you could immolate your rear end.
Ether was used as a sedative for dentists until fairly recently.
Well, it was.
Was that why it was stopped?
Well, interestingly, ether is a pretty good anesthetic, and its use recreationally predated its use as an anesthetic. So in Philadelphia, for example, in the 1840s and 30s, it was popular to have parties called ether frolics, where people would consume ether recreationally. And it was a medical student at University of Pennsylvania who realized that, hey, this could be a pretty good surgical anesthetic.
The psychoactive drugs you mentioned earlier tended to be connected to shamanic quests for insights. But is that true in Latin America, in South America, and in Asia?
Oh, absolutely. So, for example, in South America, we have this drug mixture called ayahuasca, the active ingredient of which is a LSD-like hallucinogen called DMT that is used in a shamanic context. And opium is used in a shamanic context, for example, among the hill tribes in Thailand, as well as recreationally. So, yes, this is a very, very widespread cultural practice.
And not just among humans, as we said, animals as well. You write about Siberian reindeer and their drug use.
Oh, well, Siberian reindeer are really great story. So they like to eat the Amanita mushroom that has a drug in it called ibotenic acid. And ibotenic acid is a hallucinogen, and it causes them to hallucinate and wander off from the herd and have all kinds of trips. And the humans, the Chukchi people who live in the same area, also eat these mushrooms. The thing about ibotenic acid is that it's metabolized in the body to form another compound called mucimol. And mucimol is the thing that actually gets you high. And about 80% of the ibotenic acid is passed in the urine. So you can, if you wish, drink your own urine after tripping on these mushrooms and get high over and over and over again and recycle it. And the reindeer have realized this, and they will lick up patches of yellow snow. And the humans have realized this because there aren't always these mushrooms available. So if you're willing to take the rather severe aesthetic hit of drinking urine, you can get five doses for the price of one.
We have some comments from listeners. Craig in Manhattan asks, could this be explained as the death drive described in Freud's Beyond the Pleasure Principle? Is it good to see neuroscience supporting the early ideas, his early ideas in some ways?
Well, I don't see the pursuit of pleasure as a death drive at all, nor do I see the use of hallucinogens as a death drive. I don't actually find the connection there.
Another listener writes, the pleasure circuit also seems to support B.F. Skinner's radical behaviorism, which focuses on operant conditioning based on reinforcers.
Well, it supports it in the sense that activation of the pleasure circuit is a very, very potent reinforcer. And sure enough, if you take either a rat or a human and you implant electrodes in the pleasure center and you put them in essentially a Skinner box and allow them to self-stimulate, they will do so to the exclusion of all else. But this doesn't mean that the only things that shape our experience are these reinforcing experiences. I think the thing to appreciate is that it's a two-way street in the brain. So we are not merely prisoners of our genes and our neurochemistry. All our experience in the world modifies our brain. That's why psychotherapy works. That's why we store memories. That's how we become individuals.
One more question before we go to a break. A listener asked if murder can be something that stimulates the pleasure centers of the brain.
Well, that's a really good question. We've never had someone in a brain scanner while committing murder. So,
but we've had serial killers who we could have put under brain scans.
Well, yes. I don't know if recalling the murderer is quite the same as committing it. Mm-hmm. Though, yes, you could do that. And actually, there has been quite a bit of brain scanning work done on psychopaths and serial killers, not so much interested in the pleasure circuit, but trying to see if there is some kind of neurobiological correlate of empathy or the lack thereof. And there are some indications that is true.
David J. Linden is a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He also serves as editor-in-chief of the Journal of Neurophysiology, and he's written a book called The Compass of Pleasure, How Our Brains Make Fatty Foods, Orgasm, Exercise, Marijuana, Generosity, Vodka, Learning, and Gambling Feel So Good. It's published by Viking. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with David J. Linden, whose latest book is The Compass of Pleasure. It's published by Viking. And you were talking about brain scans. All of the things that we know about pleasure has come as a result of the new technologies?
Well, no, it hasn't. All we know about, mostly of what we know about the neurobiology of pleasure in humans has, because in humans, obviously, we can't ethically go in and mess around in brains with electrodes and anatomy and biochemical analysis. But we're not entirely dissimilar from lab rats in this result. So a lot of what informs us in this quest comes from animal research.
And that could go all the way back to the 50s, right? Wasn't there a student era in a lab in 1953, Peter Milner and James Olds, that led us into some of this thinking?
Right. So the modern era of pleasure research really began with Olds and Milner, and they were trying to put their electrodes in a part of the brain that they thought controlled sleep and waking, and they missed, and it went a few millimeters forward of their intended position, and they wound up in this pleasure center in a region called the medial forebrain bundle. And what they found is if they had a rat in a box and the rat was in area A of the box and they stimulated that area, the rat really wanted to go over there and be there all the time. And then later, if they stimulated an area B, then the rat wanted to go there in area B. And it took them a while to figure out that this was reinforcing. And then when they hooked it up to a Skinner box so that a rat could press a lever and self-stimulate in this area, kind of like Woody Allen's Orgasmatron, these rats would press this lever hundreds of times per minute, and they would do it to the exclusion of all else. So they would do it to the exclusion of eating food when they were hungry, having sex if there was a receptive rat of the opposite sex available. New parent rats would abandon their children and let them die on the floor of the cage. So it was a horrifying model of severe addiction.
Although we see similar things with humans.
Well, we do, absolutely. It's not that similar from the late stage of crack addiction or cocaine or heroin addiction or alcohol addiction.
What was the dominant theory of brain development at the time in 1953?
Well, in 1953, there was a very different view, which really focused on avoidance of pain as motivating pleasure, as motivating behavior. And it wasn't Olds and Milner were really the dominant mode of moving pleasure front and center in understanding behavior. I think the key thing that has happened in our human lineage that's worthwhile to understand is we have this ancient pleasure circuit so that we eat food, drink water, and have sex. And we can artificially activate it with all these drugs that we talked about. But the miracle that's happened in us humans comes about from the fact that this pleasure center is very heavily interconnected with higher parts of the brain having to do with cognition and decision-making and emotion and social interaction and memory. And what that means is that there's a miracle, which is that we can have activation of our pleasure centers from things that are utterly arbitrary, that have no evolutionary selective value whatsoever. Celebrity gossip, curling. I like to say that a rat can have its pleasure center activated by eating food or having sex, and we can, of course, as well. But only a human can have its pleasure center activated by fasting or abstaining from sex if they have certain cultural ideas surrounding those.
Although if you abstain enough, if you starve yourself, you wind up hallucinating. You wind up setting all sorts of drugs free in your body, natural drugs, don't you?
Well, you do. You wind up hallucinating, but that hallucination isn't necessarily pleasurable. Fasting hallucinations can be very inward-turning and self-examining and scary. They're not always blissful, the same way that that chemical hallucinogens are not always blissful.
Well, we often ask when somebody, some young celebrity who has problems with drinking or drugs or whatever, who's been to jail. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, how could they have done it again? How could they have destroyed their lives? Can't they see that this is really self-destructive? Are they going through the same thing that those rats were going through?
Well, to some extent, yes. And I think the thing to realize is that we are all of us subject to very powerful subconscious forces and motivations. And for some, these forces are very different than others. So if you look at the predisposition for addiction, it's about, on the average, about 40% genetic. And this is doesn't matter whether you're talking about gambling or alcohol or drugs or sex. It's about 40% genetic. And the non-genetic part, a lot of it has to do with life stress, starting in utero and continuing throughout life. And you might think, oh, stress, we're in the airy-fairy psychological realm now. We've left biology behind. But actually, when you're stressed, your adrenal glands secrete stress hormones, and they pass into your brain, and they bind receptors on the neurons in this pleasure circuit. So we actually understand the biology of that. And when you see how these things come together, the only rational model of addiction that makes sense is a disease model. And the only rational attitude towards addicts that makes sense is one of compassion. But this doesn't mean that we just say, oh, okay, then any kind of antisocial behavior should be allowed. I mean, imagine someone goes in to see their cardiologist, and we say, you've got heart disease. We don't say, you have heart disease, you're immoral, you have no willpower, you suck, you have heart disease. No, we say, you have heart disease. It's not your fault you have heart disease, but now that you know you have heart disease, it's your responsibility to eat right, to get some exercise, to take your meds, to see your doctor, and if you don't, it's your own darn fault. And we should have the same attitude for addicts. We should say, it's not your fault that you're an addict. You have something wrong with your brain the same way this other guy had something wrong with his heart. But now that you know you're an addict, you better seek treatment, engage in stress reduction, avoid your triggers, get in therapy, take anti-craving drugs where they're available. And if you don't, it's your own darn fault. It's not a free ride to have a disease-based model of addiction.
My guest is Professor David J. Linden, a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. His book, The Compass of Pleasure, published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How does the treatment of Parkinson's disease affect the pleasure circuit of a person?
Well, so Parkinson's disease is really interesting. So when we know about Parkinson's disease because of its effect on motor behavior. People have an intention tremor and have a hard time starting their movements. And Parkinson, when he discovered it, thought that it was solely a disease of motion. And it turns out actually to be a disease of personality as well. And in the later stages of Parkinson's disease, people become anhedonic. They become unavailable to feel pleasure. And they become very withdrawn, very un-novelty-seeking. They don't want to go out. They don't want to interact. Nothing seems worthwhile. However, when you are treating people in the mid-stages of Parkinson's disease, when some of their dopamine-containing neurons are dead, but they're not all dead, you give drugs that boost dopamine signaling. And those drugs can produce this amazing transformation in personality, where Parkinson's patients who are normally very personally conservative in their habits and withdrawn suddenly become risk takers and novelty seekers. They start compulsively gambling, having risky sex, doing all these very un-Parkinsonian things.
What is weight homeostasis?
Weight homeostasis is deeply depressing to me personally, who's sporting a few extra pounds. And weight homeostasis is a means that our body has to try to keep our weight within a certain range. And so when we become thinner than our genetically determined set point, then our brains work to increase our appetite and decrease our metabolism. And likewise, when we become heavier than a certain set point, our brains work to decrease our appetite and increase our metabolism. And so how does the brain know what you weigh? Well, the way it knows is that your fat cells secrete a hormone called leptin, and this hormone passes into the brain, and leptin then causes your appetite to be reduced and your metabolism to be increased. But the problem is that not everyone is as receptive to leptin as others. And so we get very judgmental as a society about people who are overweight. We say, well, look, why can't you just eat less and exercise more? It's simple. I did it. Why can't you do it? Well, it turns out that if you look at body mass index, it's 80% heritable. That's enormous. That's larger than any other trait besides height, larger than things we commonly agree run in families like breast cancer and schizophrenia. And so people who are obese, and in particular morbidly obese, about 10% of them have metabolic problems, but about 90% of them are just because they eat too much. Why do they eat too much? Well, it's not just a lack of willpower. It's because they're craving for food because of their ability to sense leptin and also because of the other biochemical steps involved are turned down compared to others.
I always assumed there was an environmental thing of a family where the parents are way overweight. They're going to feed their kids more, and then it's just the pattern just continues.
Well, environment does have a lot to do with it, and particular food preferences are very environmentally determined. But we know from adopted identical twin studies that if you take monozygotic twins and raise them in two different families, their likelihood of having similar body mass indexes is extraordinarily high and points to this 80% heritable component.
Does age change things? Because many people maintain pretty much the same weight throughout their lives, although if they quit smoking, they usually put on a bit more weight. But then they hit a certain age, and thin people will often get thinner, and overweight people or people who might have had a normal weight will get heavier.
Yes, both appetite and metabolism change with age. And for metabolism, most people, their metabolism slows down. So most people, to maintain the same weight, can't eat the same amount and exercise the amount and have the same body mass index as they get older. And I think we don't need neurobiology to tell us that. We know from experience.
Are foods, certain foods, addictive?
Are certain foods addictive? Well, you know, I don't know if I would go so far as to say addictive, but we are hardwired to overconsume certain foods. And the problem here is that evolution is a very slow process, and cultures and technologies change very fast. So our appetite system is very well adapted for when we lived in hunter-gatherer societies and there were intermittent famines, and when we encountered calorie-dense things like fatty foods or sweet foods that were very rare, it made sense to snarf them all down and pack on a little fat for the next coming famine. That was an adaptive behavior. But now, those of us who live in the first world, who have access to essentially unlimited calories, we're not very well served by that ancient hardwiring.
I want to get to some questions that members of my staff, women in my staff, have posed. In politics or show business, isn't sexual infidelity sometimes just a question of opportunity?
Need a neurobiologist for this?
Let's face it, one writes, aren't some men just insensitive, self-involved, narcissistic, womanizing creeps? But we are shocked by the fact that some people who should know better, they've been in the headlines recently, governors and local politicians, have crossed those lines. We had the governor of a major state going to Argentina to be with a girlfriend and lying about it. These people are
no. You see, I think people just
taking incredible chances.
That was a vocal problem. He said, "I'm going to get some Argentinian tail." They just heard I'm hiking the Appalachian Trail. He was trying to be honest.
But is there such a thing really as sex addiction?
Oh, sex addiction is absolutely real. It is totally 100% real, but it's very likely that none of these people that we're talking about have been in the news lately are sex addicts. So sex addiction is real but rare. So addiction, if we took an autobiography of a sex addict and a heroin addict and a gambling addict and put them in front of us and then paid someone to take out the words that made particular reference to those particular vices and then looked at the story arc would all be the same. And it would be, I did this thing, it felt good, so I did it more, and it was great, so I did it more, and then I needed more and more. And then I got to the point where I did it just, I needed to do it just to get up in the morning, just to feel right. All my liking had been transformed into wanting. And I had to do it just not to feel the withdrawal symptoms.
That's
so
what a heroin addict once told me. He just had to, at a certain point, he had to take heroin to feel normal.
To feel normal, to feel healthy, to get healthy is the phrase that heroin addicts use when they're looking for their morning shot. I need to get healthy, which is kind of, you know, a remarkable phrase, but that's how it feels, just to face the day, not to feel great, but just to face the day.
And not to get high.
And so what that means is if you've progressed as a sex addict, you're not liking sex anymore. So just having a strong sex drive, just having a lot of sex, just having a lot of sexual partners, just being kinky, none of these things make you a sex addict. If you are a true sex addict, you've gotten to that point where the liking has been transformed into wanting, and you've got to have a new partner every night just to not have an anxiety attack, just to get up in the morning and fall asleep and deal with the world.
Allison asks, what makes television so addictive? Is it all about pleasure too, or is it more complicated than that? When you're watching a suspenseful series, is that sensation of suspense addictive?
Well, I think suspense in television or theater or in books keys into something which is that we are hardwired to pay attention to things that are salient. When something is suspenseful, it's tricking our brain into thinking, this is relevant for my survival. And this is the same way in which pleasure and pain are not entirely dissimilar.
Well, this is also when people need adventure. Some people need adventure.
Oh, yes, your so-called adrenaline junkies. And so this actually gets back to our famous people, right? So we were asking, well, you know, so these famous people who have, you know, treated people badly and strayed sexually and lied and betrayed, you know, why are they doing that? Well, the thing to realize is that the genetic component that makes you novelty-seeking and risk-taking and compulsive, right, and makes you more likely to be an addict, makes you more likely to engage in risky sexual practices, more likely to gamble to excess. Those same traits have a good side. That novelty-seeking and that risk-taking, that's what you want in your visionary CEO. That's what you want in your leader in the world of sports or politics.
And Charles asks, does meditation affect the same parts of the brain as the drugs that you're talking about?
Well, that's a really great question. So I love there's the world leader in studying meditation neurobiologically is a fellow named Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin. And he says, meditation, the word meditation is like the word sports. In other words, there are so many different forms of meditation and they have so many different patterns of brain activation that it's like saying, well, you say sports, but do you really mean hockey or football or tennis? So certainly there are some meditative practices that in some people can activate brain pleasure centers, but not all meditative practices and not in all people seem to do that.
David J. Linden, his book, The Compass of Pleasure, How Our Brains Make Fatty Foods, Orgasm, Exercise, Marijuana, Generosity, Vodka, Learning, and Gambling Feel So Good. It's published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me here. It's been a lot of fun.